Good morning. Well, it's the 1st of February, and if you survived dry January and are looking forward to having a glass later, maybe avoid this particular drink.
Now, if you're a Prosecco fan, which I am definitely not, an Australian nutritionist has revealed why Prosecco leaves you with the worst hangover, involving stronger waves of nausea and drier mouth and a more intensely pounding headache than any other booze. The answer lies in the bubbles, in case you didn't know. The carbon dioxide carried in the fizz of sparkling wine causes alcohol to absorb faster and deeper into the bloodstream, and that the higher blood alcohol levels cause more severe inflammation of the brain, which is the reason drinkers experience crippling hangover symptoms like fatigue, vomiting and migraines, lovely, the morning after. Studies show over two-thirds of people get drunker faster when they drink Prosecco, champagne or other sparkling wines compared with any other type of booze. So tread carefully. Because you know sometimes you go to a function, be it a wedding or some awful thing that you have to go to that you don't want to go to, and then they bring out the warm Prosecco or cava, like a glass of cava, and you sit there and there's always somebody who gets maggoty too quickly. Always. And you think, what were you... Did you not have something, get even a bit of toast or something? You know, you knew that it was going to be... And they're like, come here to me, I haven't seen you for ages. How's everything? You're going, oh no. I'm grand. I just have to go over here. Where's that? It's anywhere for you're not.
Ooh, harsh, Ryan Tuberty. It's the fault of the bubbles, clearly. But it's just after 9 o'clock, so in case you were wondering, yes, it is too early. Let's talk economics. That'll sober us all up. New figures from the Central Statistics Office show that household wealth has recovered by 80% since 2013, and the rich are getting richer. Robert Short crunched the numbers with Anya Lawler on the News at One.
There's a big gap between what the top 10% of households have in terms of net wealth. So the top 10 is over €800,000.
Yikes.
Compared to the bottom decile, the bottom 10%, who have assets of just over €1,000.
And that would tally, wouldn't it, with recent figures from Oxfam about the growth of billionaires in Ireland. But of course, the growing inequality doesn't mean that overall people aren't getting better despite the recession.
If you like, it's going to bolster people's love affair with property. Because basically, as long as the value of their property has increased, their measure of net wealth has increased as well. But I do think, and you made reference there to, you know, the growth of millionaires or whatever. One of the findings in this trove of statistics, which I think is absolutely fascinating and goes to the heart of this debate that's going on internationally about where wealth is going and whether we're moving back to the way it was in the 19th century. Thomas Piketty, this
An argument
well-known
about the growth
French
of inequality.
Economist.
There's two ways of looking at the world, which is there's less poverty overall and more people are living better lives. On the other hand, that inequality is growing.
So one of the findings is that amongst the top 10% of households, 67.6% of them received either a substantial gift or an inheritance, compared to just over 10% of the bottom 10% of households. And even that in itself hides the extent of that, because the substantial gift is self-described. So in other words, somebody at the bottom 10% could have received a gift of €1,000. It may be substantial to them, but may not be substantial in the general scheme of things. So there's even a lot below what we've been told already. There's a huge amount of data here, and I think it'll have social scientists and economists and people generally interested in the way society is
going. It sounds fascinating, and I'd love to talk about it for the next hour, because there's all kinds of things in there. It's the way we've been living in numbers, really, isn't it? And it's a very interesting way of looking at ourselves.
A whirlwind schooling in economics there, as heard on the News at One. However, spending your disposable income on flash cars might risk turning you into, well, something of a jackass. According to new research from the University of Helsinki, people drawn to luxury brand vehicles are ruder and more aggressive than other car drivers. On Drive Time, Philip Boucher-Hayes booked psychology professor Ian Robertson.
They took a sample of the population, it was representative, and they gave them a personality test, and there's the famous five-factor personality test, and then cross-referenced that to the cars they drove, and they found that men who had a feature of being a disagreeable personality were more likely to drive these high-status cars, but also more conscientious people were also more likely to drive the high-status cars. And they they set this explanation against a much older finding, which has been very well replicated, which is that people of higher status cars, who presumably because they're wealthy, more often break the rules, break the traffic rules, behave inconsiderately as drivers, and that's thought to be because of the corrupting effects of wealth in certain types of people.
So does the reverse also follow then? If you drive a very modest old banger, are you more likely to be a much more considerate driver?
Not necessarily, but statistically, yes. Because in the dominance in the dominance hierarchy that is our roads, you have a lower status car and you do not feel the sense of power and entitlement that comes from driving a higher status car and from the wealth that's associated with that. And so, yes, you're more likely to behave in a considerate way. Statistically speaking, there are many exceptions to this, to other people on the road.
And, of course, it's not money that is the root of all evil. It's the love of money.
People who are wealthy, who have materialist values, it's not that wealth makes you by itself behave badly. It doesn't. But wealth combined with materialist values, having central materialist values, that is a toxic combination that tends to make you rather self-important, narcissistic, feel that the rules apply to other people and not to you, and therefore to behave badly.
I feel the need to get you to make a full disclosure here. What do you drive yourself?
I have a 13-year-old battered two-door Mercedes, I confess. And I'm very conscientious.
So does that put, it being a Mercedes, though, does that put you in the two personality types?
You'll have to ask my colleagues about my agreeableness.
I think that's called humble bragging. That was Professor Ian Robertson, as heard on Drive Time. But staying with money, it's been well publicised that we're rummaging down the back of the couch here in Montrose for the spare coins. And one man who might be looking to make more money is Ray Darcy. He was joined in studio by Frank of Weddings by Frank fame.
Most wedding bands are now
how much?
2,500.
Right. You need a DJ after that then.
Yeah, DJ.
But how much is the DJ? I'm just asking for my own.
Because you could go like your own gigs.
No, in case I'm thinking of going back on the road.
That's what I'm saying. Would you like book gigs? Oh, I get you 800.
Would you? Would you give me 800?
I would. No bother.
Right.
Oh, Nixer is on the side. That's what it's coming to. On Thursday, Ryan spoke to aspiring filmmaker Danny Miller. He has cerebral palsy, which makes conventional speech difficult, so he uses technology to communicate.
How has technology helped you to communicate?
Using this device, I think I weave into conversations pretty damn easy. I use my device every day to express my thoughts and feelings, to talk with my family and friends, and at college to participate in group discussions.
And that obviously eases your way through life in a way before it could never have happened without this technology. So what do you think, Danny, your life would be like without the technology you're using for our interview today?
Non-existent. Can you imagine knowing everything you want to say inside your head, but not being able to say it out loud? It can be quite isolating, and people can feel quite awkward and uncomfortable. When you cannot speak out loud and respond to questions or participate normally, in inverted commas, in a conversation, people can be very judgmental. And many people have thought I am intellectually disabled or just plain stupid.
And Ryan asked him how school had been for him.
It was very difficult, but some of that was my own fault. Think of your worst teenage nightmare as a parent, then multiply that by 10. Instead of me being brave enough to embrace my difference, I tried too hard to be like everybody else, and this just did not work. I used the note facility on my mobile phone, which meant that I was pretty much silent throughout secondary school. People never heard what I had to say because it took me a long time to type what I wanted to say, They lost interest waiting, and then they had to read the notes from my phone, which made the whole interaction very fake and awkward. On reflection, I should have been braver, because this communication technology, the SL50, levels the playing field, so to speak, if you pardon the pun.
What amazing technology that was. Danny Miller with Ryan Tuberty. On Thursday, the new strain of the coronavirus was declared a global health emergency by the World Health Organization. And yesterday, two people in Britain tested positive for the virus. Sean O'Rourke spoke to Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College.
Can you take us through the process for developing a vaccine for the coronavirus, or how quickly one might become available?
Good morning. Yes, not quickly is the answer. We've had a number of viral emergencies in the past, and the most obvious one would be HIV, which was, you know, several decades ago, and we still don't have a vaccine against it. So it's not a trivial process to make a new vaccine against a new virus. Having said that, the Ebola virus, which was a pandemic problem in 2014, there was a very rapid response to that in terms of vaccine. A vaccine was actually put on the market last year as a result of very rapid work, but that took several years. So we're not talking about something that's going to happen overnight. It's going to take a number of years, or even up to 10 years before you'd have a vaccine against a new virus.
And Professor Mills pointed out that this virus was not the same kind of medical emergency that, say, Ebola was. And if you were healthy to begin with, it might not necessarily prove fatal. However, might the pace of the spread of the virus be concerning?
The numbers seem to be rising. I heard one expert or analyst saying earlier, by about 25% a day when you take the number of cases that have arisen and the number of deaths.
Yeah, I think that'll peak pretty soon because of the constraints now being put in place on travel. I mean, it's all about contact. So the spread of the virus is through nasal or coughing, sneezing. And if you have to really be in the proximity of somebody who has the infection to get infected, or that's the usual mode of transmission. So if you isolate people that are infected and you restrict travel from infected areas, that's the best way of containing the spread of this virus.
Well, also on the line was Yvonne Murray, RTE reporter in China, who had made the decision to leave the country. She talked about the atmosphere in the airport and on the plane.
In the airport, every single person in the queue for check-in was wearing a mask. Some had just the surgical masks, others kind of improvised cloth masks, and others had full-on smog masks, kind of more or less covering their whole face. All of the staff were wearing gloves when they were handling bags. They asked everybody to fill out a declaration as to whether you had been to the affected region any time since the middle of January. The airport screening took a little bit longer than usual because they were asking people to walk very slowly through the temperature checks. They weren't doing individual testing, but everybody had to walk through the screening where the heat sensors were checking people's temperature. Now, when we got on the flight eventually, and we were wearing our mask all the time and constantly spraying our hands with this sanitizer, when we got on the flight, we noticed that there was a man three rows in front of us who was coughing and spluttering. The airline staff looked a bit concerned. Everybody around us looked a bit concerned. Sitting in a confined space with this man for a long period of time was going to be an 11-hour flight. And then eventually the air steward did go up to him and asked if he wouldn't mind if they took his temperature, which they duly did. And everybody kind of held their breath as they took his temperature, and it turned out to be absolutely fine.
A relief for all concerned, no doubt. That was Yvonne Murray, as heard on the Sean O'Rourke show yesterday. Earlier in the week, all this talk of contagion and hygiene had focused the minds of callers to Liveline, who had rather a different take on the whole affair. Margaret got in touch. She wanted an end to handshakes as the sign of peace at mass, in her mind a veritable petri dish of the worst kind of germs. But Jean rang in, and Jean, well, she likes a little bit of dirt.
I don't know where people are going. To me, there was never as much in the world, and we were never as clean. So
that's true, but I suspect from what you're saying, Jean, that you think we're too clean. That we're not as immune to viruses and germs and infections as we were heretofore.
Yes, Yeah, and now, and I'm not dirty either. Do you know what I'm saying to you? I keep everything clean, but I'm not
OTT. Can I come in there, Joe?
Yes, Margaret, yes.
Hello, Jean.
Hello.
Jean, what I'm saying is, you don't see somebody sneezing onto a £5 note and handing it to you.
Well, wait,
but it's
you.
When you're sitting inside in the church and you see somebody coughing and sneezing, and they have, I mean, it's a natural reaction to put your hand up. Well, if they put their into their elbow, it would be one thing. But no, they'll put their hands up and they're coughing and they're sneezing. And then they'll hand you their hand. I mean, nobody sneezes into a tenner or a fiver. And
how
then
do you
will
know?
Maybe they did, but what I'm saying, I didn't see them.
Now, but that doesn't make it clean.
Are you telling me if someone sneezed into a fiver that you would take it?
Well, I'm telling you, I wouldn't refuse it.
Legal tender, after all, but luckily Barbara got in touch with a solution.
You wear gloves?
Well, I do, and I shake hands with the glove. If I think the person is coughing and sneezing, I leave the glove on. If I think I'm in the clear, I take the glove off. You know, I mean, it's rude usually to take hands with gloves, I would suppose.
Yeah, it is.
And so I take them to mask, and if there's somebody coughing and sneezing, or I think I just don't want to chance, I would leave the glove off. And just lightly, you know, with sort of, I don't know what they think, I just lightly shake hands then. But normally I wouldn't mind, you know. If it's,
yeah. And have like you had, say, what experiences have you had
nasty,
Barbara?
I had a nasty experience of the basket coming around with for the money, and the gentleman in front of me, a young man, was coughing and spluttering all through mass, and a very, very heavy cold. And he was using his hanky, no problem. And he turned and handed me the basket, and unfortunately, I took the basket, and there was phlegm on my hand.
Okay.
And I have a friend who hates the sinuses, but and I haven't had the courage to tell her.
Yeah, but Barbara, didn't our Lord walk with lepers?
No, he did indeed. But you know, I think he might have had a better immunity system than us. What do you think?
And that is the pure joy of Liveline, from phlegm to the immune system of our good Lord Jesus Christ, because you just never know what you're going to get. Back after this. Welcome back. January 27th, 2020 marked the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. The drama on one slot brought us Auschwitz and Echo Trapped Forever with Holocaust expert Pavel Zawitski.
Jews are a race that must be totally exterminated. Hans Frank, 1944, Governor General in Nazi-occupied Poland.
They're begging us, you see, in their wordless way, to do something, to speak on their behalf, or at least not to close the door again.
Szacunkowa liczba Żydów deportowanych do KL Auschwitz. Estimated number of Jews deported to Auschwitz. 430 tysięcy z Węgier, 430,000 from Hungary, 300 tysięcy z Polski, 300,000 from Poland, 69 tysięcy z Francji. We must free the German nation of Poles, Russians, Jews and Gypsies. Otto Tirak, Minister of Justice of the Third Reich.
And one of the most heartbreaking aspects of the camps were the normal, everyday objects people had carried with them.
So we are standing in a room where you can actually see hope that people had, because we're standing in front of this display where you can see different types of kitchenware, and there are thousands of items, and you can see jars, and you can see bowls, and you can see kettles, and you can see different kinds of lamps, you can see normal cups, you can see plates, everything that the people brought with them to start normal kitchen. You can see also colors, different colors, and these colors are important because they also tell about the identity of people who own these items. But you can see three main colors visible. You can see white, you can see blue, and you can see red all around. And this is because Jewish kitchen must be kosher. And at that time, to mark the dishes which were for different kinds of food, meat, dairy, and parf, were marked with different colors. So we can also see that in most cases, the people who owned these items were Jews. And the hope is very clear, because when you believe that you are just changing your place of living, when you believe in resettlement, and this is the story that the German Nazis gave to people, you take things like that with you. When you move, you want to have a new kitchen, because a kitchen is a very important place in every household. You meet their family, you talk, you gossip, you eat, you rest. So we can see that people had hope for some continuation. And this hope was the weapon that Germans used against them. And this is what helped them to take people as calm as possible, but also as quickly as possible, from the selection point to the gas chambers.
And then we were brought into the gas chambers themselves, where deception was necessary to facilitate killing on such a massive scale.
So we are looking at the factory of death, with two underground rooms, long and dressing room on the left-hand side where people entered, and they believed that this is just a shower and dressing room. This is the story that they were told by the perpetrators. They were told to remember the number of the hook where they put their clothes. They were given sometimes towel and soap for the shower. They were told to tie their shoes together, not to lose them after the shower, to be able to find them. And then people were moved to another room. And in here, we can see another underground room, and this is the gas chamber. There were artificial shower heads on the ceiling, because deception lasted until the very last moment, and people entered. Around 2,000 people could be killed here at the time. The door was locked, and that was the trap closing. And then through holes in the ceiling, Cyclone B pallets were thrown inside the chamber, and hydrogen cyanide started killing people, and the process lasted, well, 20, 30 minutes. And then the Sonderkommando started their work, cleaning the gas chamber.
Pavel Zawitski, as heard on Auschwitz, an echo trapped forever from the drama on One Slot on Sunday. On Monday morning, Ryan Tuberty spoke to Rainer Huss. This is how he introduced himself.
I'm the grandson of Rudolf Huss, who was the former and founder of the Auschwitz extermination camp in 1940. So he was responsible for more than 1.3 million killings in that camp.
And growing up as a child, Rainer had no idea of who his grandfather had been. His own father refused to acknowledge the facts of his childhood living in a villa on the grounds of the camp.
For me, it was important to see, while it was all that kind of denying all the time and glorification about my grandfather, what my father really saw in that period. So when I went in and opened the window, and I saw everything. I saw the gas chamber, I saw the crematoria, I saw the hanging spots. So if people not were there, so you saw everything. So how can a kid grow up in that environment with activities around? And then I spoke to people like Joseph Paczynski. He was the barber of my grandfather, and asked him if there were walls around when he came to Auschwitz in 1940. He said no, everything was open. So the walls were built up in 1941. So when the kids, they had signs around their neck with the names on it, so that they not get mixed up with any transports from different countries with Jews or prisoners. At all. So, and the kids, they grow up in an environment where they have everything. They have ponds, they have different animals. And what was really specific, like the saying of my grandmother, that she said to the kids with the greenhouses, so before you eat the vegetables or the fruits, you have to wash it while it's full of ash. So there was one really pregnant thing in that way. So you were there, I know it, and it's nearly 100 meters away from the crematoria. Mm-hmm. And you said, yeah, sometimes it was really strange when all the black smoke came over, and it was a disgusting smelling, so about burning human flesh. But she called that part paradise. And that was one of my major questions in my research. If she called it her paradise, how must hell look for her in that way?
And it was that ability to continuously lie and deny facts that have forced Rainer Huss to break off all contact with his family.
It's really, that's past for me, that family.
Why?
I cannot live with that nonsense that he never made anything wrong. that it was okay, and he was not a commandant of an extermination camp. He was a commandant of a prison. So how can I deny things like that? And in all that research I made, I found the names which were really close to my family, like Professor Fourisson, one of the biggest Holocaust deniers in the world. And I found blogs where he mentioned my aunt in America who delivered images and said, no, nothing happens. Mm-hmm. And he said they had enough food, nothing went wrong, so they never get beaten up. Everything was really beautiful for these for these persons. Yeah, but they were in prison, they make something wrong.
Why did you keep your grandfather's name when a lot of people might have said it's time to change it?
What would you invite me to your show if I would call myself Mr. Müller?
No,
I don't think so.
No, I probably wouldn't know who you are. But you make a good point.
Yeah, but if I use my family name, I have no problem with it. I never made anything wrong in the Second World War. I was not even born in it. But to use it as a tool and as a good weapon against the far right and all these revisionists, racists, that's the point in it.
It is the point. I understand that entirely.
Rainer Huss with Ryan Tuberty. Later that same day, Ray Darcy replayed an interview he had done with Auschwitz survivor Edith Eger.
You arrived and you're in lines and the infamous Joseph Mengele was there. And you had been separated into various lines going, you didn't know where. And there's that moment that you visit and revisit where you're asked if your mother is your sister or your mother.
Yes, exactly. And I never forgave myself by saying it's my mother because I had no idea what was going on. And pointing my mom to go to the left, and I followed my mom, and he grabbed me and he said, "You're gonna see your mother very soon. She's just gonna take a shower." So the very man who sent my mom to the gas chamber is the very man who threw me on the other side, which meant life, you see.
And later, during her time in the camp, Edith would be forced to dance for Joseph Mengele.
And as I was dancing, I didn't know whether he was going to send me to the gas chamber because he was talking to someone there who might be going to the gas chamber, and I was praying so it wouldn't be me, the next one, and I closed my eyes and I pretended that the music was Tchaikovsky and I was dancing the Romeo and Juliet at the Budapest Opera House because that was my dream. Mm. And I dissociated and I checked out. And then he gave me a piece of bread. And that piece of bread that I shared with the girls later on saved my life because I was in a death march and I was going to be shot. And they came and they carried me. They formed a human chair with their arms. Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that amazing that they remembered that you had given them some bread?
Yes. That the worst condition brings out the best in us.
Yeah.
If you were only for the me, you never made it. You had to really commit yourself to someone, and that was my sister, but all of us, we had to really have cooperation, not competition, not domination, because all we had was each other then, and guess what? All we have is each other now.
Now, yes.
And Edith Eger spoke about the human capacity for choice, even in the most dire of circumstances.
We were just, you know, totally hungry, cannibalism broke out, and then people were eating other people's flesh, you know. I think God told me that I still have something to eat, and I ate grass. And I remember looking down and still choosing one blade of grass over the other. So today I tell people, you still have a choice.
Mm.
And don't say, I can't, because I can't means you're helpless.
Auschwitz survivor Edith Eger as heard on Ray Darcy.
Pierwsze na śmierć iść miały dzieci, osierocone małe dzieci. The first to perish were the children, abandoned orphans. The world's best, the bleak earth's brightest. These children from the orphanages might have been our comfort. From these sad, mute, bleak faces, our new dawn might have risen. Jakże mam śpiewać? Świat cały obrócił mi się w pustynię. Jak grać mam, kiedy daremnie ręka podźwignąć się sili? How can I sing? My world is laid waste. How can I play with wrung hands? Where are my dead? O God, I seek them in every dunghill, in every heap of ashes. O tell me where you are. Spójrz, stoją wszyscy, gdzie tylko ziemia się wokół rozściela. Look, they all stand around me, endless throngs. A shudder goes through me. All of them look with Benzion's and Yomke's sorrowful eyes. All of them look with the sad eyes of my murdered wife. Muszę cię twoim wołać imieniem, Hanewe, choćby wymawiać imię. I love calling your name. I love to say it, Hanale. Since they took you away with my people, I fancy chatting with you. You look at me sweetly with your bright eyes, a gentle, sad smile on your lips. I love calling you in my loneliness, asking you in my solitude, do you remember? Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
Welcome back. Now, we're pretty much an election-free zone here on Playback, fairness and balance and all that. But it seems electionitis has hit voters out there. Cian McCormick was in at the Lone for the News at One, where, frankly, ennui and disillusionment seemed to be the chanson du jour.
The election is happening, obviously, at the moment. Any standout points in the campaign thus far?
Nothing so far for me, a lot of promises.
But what does that mean when it comes to polling day?
I don't know, because like you have to look at all the options. Like one party and one person will say they'll give you this and another one will say they'll give you that. But you've got to look at the overall picture and just work out what's best for you.
And what's the overall picture?
I really don't know at the moment.
What do you think of the campaign so far?
It's been very mediocre.
Mediocre? Why?
There's no difference between Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. I don't believe there's a strong alternative. What difference is it going to make? Like, I mean, we have the politicians beating down the streets here, telling us what they're going to do and all the rest of it. As soon as this election is over, they're just going to disappear into the ether again.
Election 2020 well underway. We've gone past the halfway point. What's the standout moment in this campaign for you?
To be honest, I haven't even been looking at it because I have no faith in any of them.
Ah, come on now.
Honestly, I think I'm going to vote...
But is it just an easy thing to say? I don't have any faith in any of them.
It's not an easy thing to say. It's a horrible thing to say.
You know, how will that influence your vote then?
I'm just going to have to sit down and have a serious think about it and see what they're all standing for. Because as far as I'm concerned, they have a load of promises.
Oh, February 8th can't come fast enough, I think. The concept of home is the focus for the Davis Now lectures. And this week, artistic producer and theatre practitioner Rosha Gowan explored how contemporary notions of home have changed theatre. And with home ownership being out of reach for many young people, how does that affect the way we represent home?
Perhaps, if not with contempt, but with some censure, my generation, those who don't own property or have proper pension plans, are referred to as the avocado and toast generation. Or, you know, the first generation in memory to be less well off than the one that came before them. Much as I love a smashed avocado, I find this judgment a little bit harsh. You know, yes, perhaps we value experience over assets, but what have the strictures of buildings and the architecture of the past shown us? We have a deep distrust of institutions, of fixed ideas as well as fixed mortgages. It's not for nothing that the art that this post-Gen X generation of Irish artists have made canon, has taken the theatre out of the building and indeed out of the playtext. Experience is the thing we can trust. Experience is what makes both the comfort and crucially the discomfort of home.
Rosha Gowan recorded in the Glebe House in Donegal for the Davis Now lectures. On Tuesday's Sean O'Rourke show, Brian O'Connell visited the Poor Clares, an enclosed order in Cork.
There are just 7 nuns left in the order in Cork. They live a life of poverty, chastity, obedience and enclosure. They receive 3 visits a year from family members. And my visit was in a room where they just a see-through partition in between us. And it's a community, Sean, that likes to get up very early in the morning, 5:30. Here first is Sister Frances describing her day for me yesterday.
Well, this morning we got up at 6. Now, normally it's 5:30.
You had a lie-in.
We did a sleep-in, yeah, exactly. We say the Angelus, of course, first, and the bell goes and the local people hear the bell, and then we have Mass at 7:30. We never do work that's so absorbing that you can't be thinking or pondering or talking to the Lord. Our whole day basically is prayer and work and, you know, answering the bell, answering letters or whatever.
It's not a silent community, but you observe quietness. Would that be correct?
Very good.
You're up early, so you must have to go to bed quite early, would you?
We do, yeah. We go to bed at 8:00, but a light's out at 9:15. But we're up again at 10 to 12. No, not every night. And again, we have what we call the Office of Readings. It's the very first liturgical hour of the day, because you're into the new day.
So you're up at midnight for an hour?
An hour, yeah, an hour.
And then back to bed?
Back to bed, yeah. We get to go to sleep twice. That's one way of looking at it. We take a vow of enclosure, mm-hmm. which means that basically we stay in habitually unless going out for the dentist, the doctor, the vote.
And would you throw on the news?
Twice a day. 1:00, RTE News. Plug. And 7:00. And on Christmas, for the whole, what we call the octave of Christmas and holiday kind of special feast days, 9:00 news on the TV. You know, and the odd time, especially at the Christmas, we are sometimes, if there's a feast day, we might even see a bit of Dancing with the Stars.
Who's it? Oh, Father Ray's in it at
Father
the moment.
Ray
he's doing well.
Yeah. We were praying for him last night. We didn't watch it last night because we were out of the Christmas season.
Well, prayers worked because I think he got through to the next
round.
Wow, so there
we
you
didn't
go.
Expect wow. that. We didn't expect that. Fair juice.
He's he to thank for it.
Miracles indeed, Brian.
Sister Frances with Brian O'Connell on the Sean O'Rourke Show. And now it's Brexit time, because after all the huffing and puffing, all the bluster and threats of death in a ditch and protests and promises, hand-wringing and flag-waving, it finally came to pass. The United Kingdom has left the European Union. The Sean O'Rourke Show brought us this reminder of how it had all started.
This ceremony today marks an end and also a beginning. An end to divisions which have stricken Europe for centuries. A beginning of another stage in the construction of a new and a greater united Europe. This is the task which now lies ahead for our generation in our own continent.
The then UK Prime Minister Edward Heath, speaking in 1973 as Britain joined the European Economic Community, as it was then known. And on Wednesday, British MEPs cast their final vote in Parliament. Drivetime brought us this clip and, well, it wasn't exactly a dignified farewell.
There's an historic battle going on now across the West, in Europe, America and elsewhere. It is globalism against populism. And you may loathe populism, but I tell you a funny thing, it's becoming very popular. And it has great benefits. No more financial contributions, no more European Court of Justice, no more common fisheries policy, no more being talked down to, no more being bullied, no more Guy Verhofstadt. I mean, what's not to like? I know you're going to miss us. I know you want to ban our national flags, but we're going to wave you goodbye and we'll look forward in the future to working with you as sovereign.
If you disobey the rules, you get cut off. Could we please remove the flags? Mr. Farage.
Well, that's it. It's all over. Finished. We're gone.
Could I please ask for quiet? I'm really... Please sit down, resume your seats, put your flags away, you're leaving, and take them with you if you are leaving now.
Mairead McGuinness and Nigel Farage in a final tête-à-tête. And yesterday, Tommy Gorman spoke to Áine Lawler on the News at One.
Tommy, I'm reminded of that line from T.S. Eliot, not with a bang but a whimper. After all the torrid political debate of the past 3.5 years, this is almost an anticlimax today, isn't it?
In a way, yes. But I think if we reflect on it for any time at all, we realise that today something really, really fundamental has changed. History is happening in a very quiet way today. Symbolism of the European Commission office on the Dublin Road in Belfast, the signage being removed, that office closing. And it comes back to you, Áine, that this place, Northern Ireland, I'm sitting in Enniskillen as we speak, and this place is going to have the only land frontier with the United Kingdom and the European Union it has just left. I also think today of Boris Johnson. It's one thing to aspire to a job, and he has sought to be Prime Minister for a long time. Well, today I think he's up in Sunderland having a meeting of his cabinet. He put out a statement using social media tonight. But today, I think, is the day when the penny will drop for him, that he is probably the British Prime Minister of our lifetime, Áine, who has probably got the most significant set of challenges. This has never been done before. He's in a totally new space and there's no magic formula. And I think as things unfold between now and the end of the year, the future trade arrangements, how that's going to affect north, south, east and west, I think it's then we'll recognise the significance of what's happening today.
So that's it then. Brexit has come to pass as democratically decided by voters in the UK. The people have spoken. But I'm going to leave you with a little bit of Kate Tempest.
It's coming to pass. My country's coming apart. The whole thing's becoming such a bumbling farce. Was that a pivotal historical moment we just went stumbling past? Well, here we are, dancing in the rumbling dark. So come a little closer, give me something to grasp. Give me your beautiful, crumbling heart. Another disaster, catharsis, another half-discarded mirage, another mask slips. I face off with the physical, my head's ringing from the love of the stars. There is too much pretense here, and too much depends on the fragile wages and extortionate rents here. We're working every dread day that is given us, feeling like the person people meet really isn't us. Like we're gonna buckle underneath the trouble. Like any minute now the struggle's gonna finish us. And then we smile at all our friends. It's hard. We got our heads down and our hackles up, our backs against the wall. I can feel you aching. None of this was written in stone. There is nothing we're forbidden to know. And I can feel things changing. Even when I'm weak and I'm breaking, I stand weeping at the train station, 'cause I can see your faces. There is so much peace to be found in people's faces.